Welcome to Reinventing Solidarity, a podcast of the journal New Labor Forum at the School of Labor and Urban Studies at the City University of New York. My name is Micah Utrecht, podcast host and editor-at-large at New Labor Forum. Reinventing Solidarity features scholars, activists, and artists on the front lines of the working class movement, working to create a radically different world, one with solidarity, equality, and sustainability at its heart. The question of how to revive the labor movement at a time of union decline and rising power of the ultra-wealthy is a perennial one for labor organizers and observers. Labor's numbers keep on slipping, but we've also seen an explosion in interest in labor, public polling indicating the highest levels of support for unions in years, and key groups of workers waging innovative organizing campaigns at companies like Starbucks and bold strikes like the UAW's stand-up strike at the Big Three automakers last year. Labor scholar Eric Blanc argues that some of these recent organizing drives and strikes have employed common elements, what he calls a worker-to-worker organizing model, explained in his article in the spring 2024 issue of New Labor Forum, titled Worker-to-Worker Organizing Goes Viral, and in depth in his forthcoming book from the University of California Press, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Blanc argues that the worker-to-worker model allows workers to train each other and gives them tools to start organizing on their own, rather than relying on expensive and unscalable staff-heavy union organizing models. I spoke to Blanc about his article and his book and why the model of worker-to-worker organizing is worth studying and emulating. Eric Blanc is an assistant professor of labor studies at Rutgers University. He is the author of Red State Revolt, The Teachers' Strike Wave in Working Class Politics, and Revolutionary Social Democracy, Working Class Politics Across the Russian Empire, 1882 to 1917. His forthcoming book is We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Eric Blanc, welcome to Reinventing Solidarity.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Your book is all about what you classify as a new model of unionism, worker-to-worker unionism. Before we get into that model, let's talk about the union organizing model you're contrasting it against, what you call the staff-intensive model. What exactly is the staff-intensive model and what's wrong with it?
Yeah, staff-intensive unionism really is a catch-all term that refers to a lot of different types of drives, but what they have in common is that they use a lot of staff to try to win. The norm in this type of organizing, which is pervasive amongst organizing-focused unions in the U.S., at least since the 1980s, is that you need about one staffer for every 100 workers you're trying to unionize. That's the ratio that is sort of thrown out as best practice. And the basic problem with this is that it just can't scale. It's too expensive to scale, both in terms of money and time. So it just costs too much. You can't hire enough staffers to organize tens of million workers. And just time-wise, when unions grow in moments of effervescence, you don't have the ability to train up quickly enough staffers to meet these moments. And so the limitation is basically, I would argue, a question of scale. Sometimes these staff-intensive efforts can be very effective at winning changes for workers. I'm not trying to exaggerate the deficiency of the model. Hundreds of thousands of workers have seen their lives improved through this type of staff-intensive organizing at its best. It also has a lot of sort of very bad, extremely top-down, ineffective iterations. But at its best, staff-intensive organizing can be very effective. The problem is it just can't be effective enough for enough workers.
So what is the worker-to-worker model then that deals with the problems that you're identifying in the staff-intensive model?
Yeah, worker-to-worker unionism, which, as a quick reference point, people think about some of the recent drives in Starbucks, some of the higher ed organizing, some of the most recent efforts in UAW, just to get a sense of what I'm talking about in the real world. But essentially what it means is a type of organizing that builds off the best traditions of staff-intensive organizing, some of the left traditions of staff-intensive organizing that focus on identifying and developing rank and file leaders. And so building off of that very rich, and I think, very generative tradition, worker-to-worker unionism has gone even further in providing responsibilities for workers to take on tasks that are normally just for staffers. So in a staff intensive drive, typically it's up to staff to train worker leaders, and then worker leaders are in charge of winning over their coworkers, right? So the organizer organizes the workers' committee, and the workers' committee organizes the rest of the workforce. That's at its best. The worker-to-worker unionism builds off of that and says, well, workers can do some of the things that staff normally do. For instance, workers can train other workers in methods. So instead of having a staff organizer train the worker organizing committee, oftentimes at Starbucks recently and in other similar drives, you had workers over Zoom training workers organizing committees elsewhere. So the organizer position there was of a worker who'd gone through the experience of organizing their shop recently and was passing on that lessons and that training to other workers, oftentimes over Zoom, sometimes in person. So one thing that worker-to-worker unionism does differently is it gives workers the task of training other workers at other drives, and that's not just a staff. Another crucial difference is that worker-to-worker unionism often, although not always, starts with workers initiating their own drives. So in a typical staff-intensive campaign, even when it's a hot shop, and we talk a little bit more what hot shops are later if you want, workers might reach out to a union, or the union will target a workplace, but the organizing only starts really once a staffer meets with workers and starts training them in what they have to do. So the initiation of the organizing is always from day one, with close guidance from a full-time paid staffer. In contrast, a lot of these recent drives that we're seeing popping off across the country, whether they go independent or affiliate with an existing unions, they start organizing on their own. Workers start organizing. They start doing the one-on-one conversations with coworkers. They start talking about what their issues are, all of kind of the ABCs of organizing that normally happens with guidance of staffers. Workers often do this on their own. And then afterwards, they vote on whether to go independent, which is actually a minority of drives. Most of the time, they vote and decide on affiliating with an existing union because they want the resources and they want extra support. But they make that choice after they've already cohered themselves. And that really changes the dynamics and how they relate to the established union, because oftentimes in staff-intensive drives, there can be a kind of pattern of deference and of excessively relying on the established union and its staffers. And it's possible to have more of a partnership relationship once workers have already begun organizing on their own. So just to give an example, the recent ongoing union drive at Mercedes in Vance, Alabama, the workers were organizing on their own. They were thinking about maybe going independent until they met with the UAW, laid down their conditions for what it would take to affiliate. The UAW agreed. And that set in motion then a very different type of leadership dynamic than you have in most staff-intensive drives. And that brings to the last piece that's part of worker-to-worker unionism, is that workers have a decisive say over strategy, over all aspects of the strategy of a campaign. In good organizing, this sometimes happens. It's rare. In good staff-intensive organizing, there are times when workers can have a decisive say, but it's pretty rare for the reasons I already described, and it's not the norm. Whereas in worker-to-worker unionism, it's almost always the case, I would argue it's always the case, sort of by my definition, that workers are deciding not just small tactical questions like maybe like which workers we're going to reach out to first, or even like what our demands are, but all of the big questions. And that can be in conjunction with staffers. They might get guidance, they might get tips, but the workers have a decisive say over all of the issues of the campaign, whether it's when to file for an election, whether it's who to affiliate with in the first place, whether to go on strike, these types of things that are normally under the purview of staffers in most staff-intensive drives, workers have a decisive say over in worker-to-worker unionism.
What is the kind of coherence of this model? Are you describing something that you are observing among a wide range of union drives, like the companies you just mentioned at Starbucks, different UAW drives that are going on? You have a bunch of different case studies in the books. Like, are you saying after the fact that what these people are doing sort of falls under this rough umbrella of worker-to-worker unionism, or is this a model that they are consciously choosing to use in their new organizing drives in this moment of great effervescence around unionism? Where does this model come from, and like, what is the coherence of it among the different union drives that you identify as operating under this worker-to-worker model?
I think it's more the latter, which is to say that the new model has emerged sort of out of necessity of trying to scale up and to meet this moment. It's not that people necessarily read about a great new model, like, let's do that. If anything, people were building, as I mentioned, off of the best traditions of rank and file organizing, which even if it's in its staff intensive iterations, really did always have a focus on sort of skilling up and training workers. But what do you do then when you have not just a dozen workers reaching out to you, but thousands in the case of Starbucks or in UAW or in the News Guild, which is another example that, you know, we can dig into, which I think has maybe gone furthest in developing a worker to worker program. In response to this unprecedented level of interest, these campaigns had to develop new structures essentially to be able to scale up. And so it was born out of necessity and trial and error in figuring out mechanisms to be able to literally have someone to talk to all of the drives that are contacting you or all the possible new campaigns that you could launch. And so I think it builds off of old traditions, but it moves that in a very new way. And part of the reason for that is digital tools. It's just there's an ability to connect workers with other workers across the country in a way that wasn't the case 100 years ago. And a lot of these structures that unions and workers are building up now are innovative because they haven't been done before. Like, how do you do a mass training for 10,000 workers at once? You know, how do you figure out the best practices to connect workers to new drives, even if it's all the way across the country? You know, these are things that are possible now because of digital technologies and because of this new moment we're in. And so it's the kind of the convergence of good organizing traditions with the need to scale up with the affordances of digital tools have created this new model. And people, you know, when you talk to them, some people will call it worker to worker unionism. You know, I don't think that I invented that term, but it's not, I don't think, until this book, so clear what we're talking about. And that's part of the purpose of the book, is to try to really specify what are the best practices, how is it different in the past? Because a lot of times unions can say we're doing bottom-up organizing, and they're actually underestimating how much further they could go in building a model that's scalable and powerful.
So talk about some of the aspects of this model that you were just getting into. You mentioned digital tools, for example. I think probably a lot of listeners of this podcast are familiar with the kind of vulgar arguments about social movements and technology that I think we've heard a little bit over the past decade or decade and a half, you know, especially around the time of the Arab Spring, let's say, where it's just sort of like this breathless endorsement of now everything has changed in terms of social movement organizing because of the existence of tools like social media, like Zoom, et cetera. That's not the argument that you are making here. Likewise, there is a version of arguments about organizing models that are rooted in rank and file engagement, you know, quote unquote, bottom up organizing that can take this sort of vulgar anti-staff, like we're interested in empowering the workers, not the staff. And that is also an oversimplification of what you're arguing for. You don't have this kind of anti-staff orientation. So can you talk about in a bit more depth about those aspects of the model and any other ones that I'm missing?
Sure. So on the tech piece, you know, it's interesting. These days, I would say most people are kind of doom-pilled on tech, right? The norm these days isn't to feel like, tech is going to be the great new revolution, but it's to say this only helps the right wing, there's disinformation, it's disorganizing. And so while it's true that I don't share the kind of breathless optimism of, 2011 era, you know, Twitter revolutions, it's also true that I'm pushing back against this idea that all social media does is sort of help the right wing and disorganize. There's an influential argument that at its best, social media can help workers and sort of popular movements organize episodic protests, but that it can't help build sustained organization. And so the labor movement is a really interesting test case because it suggests, at least in the United States, that that isn't true. We are seeing digital tools being used to build sustainable, lasting, powerful organization. And so that's something that we really need to wrap our heads around. It doesn't mean that tech is a substitute for new organizing and for kind of a lot of the deep one-on-one relationship building practices that organizers have always kind of talked about. That remains the case, but it allows you to do that at scale and in a different way than was possible even 10 years ago. And so just, you know, to give one example of that, it's worth thinking about the emergence of this new model. I think it does go back to 2018 with the kind of viral red state teacher strikes that were organized over Facebook groups essentially, and then, you know, spread more widely. And so you saw there the ability for rank and file workers to cohere themselves and to pressure their unions in a way that just wasn't possible before, because basically digital tech lowers organizing costs. So it means that rank and file workers are less reliant on established union resources than they were in the past. It doesn't mean they don't need resources. It doesn't mean you can do it without unions, but that changes the relationship of forces. And it did sustain itself and lead to lasting organizational gains. You know, union membership increased very significantly in West Virginia and Arizona. And then now with the new organizing you're seeing all across the country, the major thing that tech does, in addition to lowering organizing costs, is that it allows worker-to-worker grassroots unionism to spread beyond a local level. So before things like Zoom, if you were a worker and wanted to train another worker, you could basically only do that with someone in your hometown, right? Someone you could meet with regularly. And so it was up to staffers to coordinate regionally and nationally. But now that's just not the case. Now you can have, as I mentioned, a Starbucks worker in Buffalo training a Starbucks worker in Mesa, Arizona. You can have graduate student workers training each other all across the country. You have auto workers training each other as we speak across the country. And so that just radically expands the pool of workers who can train other workers, and then in turn expands the reach of worker-to-worker unionism and the kind of power of the rank and file to advance without having to rely as much on union resources. But this takes us to the second point. You still do need union resources. My argument is actually very explicitly against the idea that we should counterpose rank and file power to establish union resources and staffers, because what staffers can do is add capacity, and they can pass on accumulated experience from past struggles. And so this is still really crucial. My criticism of staff-intensive organizing isn't kind of contrary to a lot of other criticisms that have been made of this, that it's inherently top-down. I don't think that's true. It can be done in a sort of a very bottom-up way. The problem, as I mentioned before, is just that it's not scalable. You can't get to the tens of millions of workers organized through that model. But that doesn't mean that you don't need staff and union resources. I would argue actually you need way more of this. In order to meet this moment to organize tens of millions of new workers, you need to see unions doing what the UAW is doing right now, spending $40 million to organize auto workers across the South, what the News Guild has done, Starbucks Workers United has done with support of Workers United and some SEIU support. This is putting real resources into new organizing. So the case is actually unions should be spending more on new organizing, but if they're going to do that in a way that can reach the millions, they have to spend less on each individual drive. So it's an absolute increase, but a relative decrease per drives. And that's the way you're going to get to scale.
So you just listed off several unions that are already doing this kind of model. Let's take the News Guild, for example. They're one of the case studies in the book. Can you talk about how they have executed this model, what that looks like within that union?
I think the News Guild has the most robust worker-to-worker organizing program in the country, in part because it's been around longer. You know, Starbucks Workers United's been around for 2 years. The UAW is just really launching its new drives right now. The bottom-up worker-to-worker piece in journalism is gone on longer. You know, you can go back to about 2018, 2019, when the News Guild really is starting to build up a new program. And as I mentioned before, this was born out of necessity. There was good organizing traditions. It's a CWA union. There's kind of a tradition of rank and file oriented unionism. But all of a sudden, they were getting all of these leads from all across the country, and they didn't have the capacity and they didn't have the number of staffers to talk to all of them. So what they started doing is basically training up what they called a member organizer program, in which members themselves would be the primary people responsible for training new drives. And they've created an extremely robust kind of back-end structure full of things like what they call pods, which are bi-weekly meetings in which you have about 10 workers from different shops across the country just to talk to each other, to get pass on tips, to give each other support. A lot of good organizing support is this interpersonal dynamic where you can vent and then get support. So it's not just sort of passing on the nitty-gritty technical issues. They have these pods. They have monthly trainings. Not just for how to organize a new shop, but on everything. How do you organize a good meeting? How do you bargain a first contract? How do you sustain organizing after you win a first contract? So they have a very dramatically expanded range of training materials. And then they just have a very robust kind of back end with a lot of Google Docs. You know, so they all kind of jokingly complain about how many Google Docs they have, which track all of the tasks that a staffer normally does. They pass that on to workers. So literally workers have a Google sheet will say, these are the tasks that we hope that you will learn over the next year. And then these are the tasks that we hope that you can learn to teach Because this is another thing that is often underestimated. It's not just learning how to organize it, but it's learning how to pass on these lessons to others. And that's a distinct skill. You both learn more when you teach others, but also to build a movement, and this is the way they talk about it, to build a movement, you need to learn how to be able to pass these lessons on to others, because you're not going to be able to do that if you just have, you know, one staffer trying to do this over and over again with new drives. So the News Guild has built up this program. They've organized hundreds and hundreds of newspapers all across the country in really hard battles. You know, as you probably know, and as listeners probably know, you know, journalism is in a crisis right now. A lot of the big media companies have been bought by hedge funds, and they're doing horrific union busting. And despite that, and in part because of the crisis, the News Guild has won first contracts across the board, not just in sort of blue states, but, you know, in places like Texas, there's been a lot of major victories. And so you see that worker-to-worker unionism can work, and it can win first contracts. This is one of the sort of knocks against bottom-up organizing. It's one of the things you'll hear a lot kind of behind the scenes when you talk to people in labor. They say, well, this all sounds good. They can maybe win elections, but can they win a first contract? Well, people saying that, A, you know, haven't given enough time to things like Amazon and, you know, Starbucks, we can talk about more, it has made a big breakthrough. They also just actually seem to not be aware of the News Guild, which has proven in practice this model's work over and over and over again. And so I do think that we should look to their successes as kind of proof of concept.
To what extent is this model just a reflection of this moment of upsurge in the labor movement that we are clearly currently in? You're describing that we need this model in order to kind of meet the demand. Literally, there's no way to scale up to the point where we can meet all of the demand for workers who are clamoring to organize right now. Does this model matter in a period of sort of like union downturn, when there is less excitement and less interest by workers in unionizing? Is this just specific to the moment of upsurge and interest in unionizing that we're currently in?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it matters less in a period of downturn, insofar as the sort of big upshot of the new model is its ability to scale. But I don't want to overstate that, because what we're talking about in the new model is not just an ability to meet and reach all of the new people reaching out. It's also an ability to plant way more seeds of organizing. And so that's important, because it's not just the case that this is kind of like a bigger scale hot shop type approach in which, you know, more workers are reaching out and you need a new way to talk to all of them. That's part of it. But if you look at the UAW, for instance, the UAW sort of had to generate momentum and generated a new level of effervescence on the ground by taking risky strike action, winning huge contract gains, and then saying, we're going to organize every worker in a non-union auto factory across the South Bend country. And so in auto, for instance, it wasn't the case that there was just like spontaneously thousands of workers reaching out. They had to do what I'd call seeding, and then build a worker-to-worker sort of program to help meet that. So all that is to say, it's not just responding to what's going on, but it's also helping kind of expand and seed the anger that exists and turning that into mass scale organizing. But it is also very clear that we're in a particular moment. You know, we're in a moment after the pandemic, we're in a moment in which young people are overwhelmingly supportive of unions, in which unions are just getting a huge amount of press attention. So I do think that the model has emerged to meet this moment. And if we don't leverage it sufficiently, the moment will pass. On the other hand, I think that it's very likely that the type of innovations that this organizing has brought to being are going to continue even if the momentum dies down. And so to be really specific about that, you know, even if momentum is killed by, let's say, the Republicans getting into power, or maybe the tight labor market goes away, you're still going to have the ability for workers to train other workers across the country. You're still going to have the ability to salt on a wide scale level. And so we haven't talked about salting yet, but it's another iteration of worker-to-worker organizing in which you can sort of seed new drives by getting young people, oftentimes socialists, to start unionizing their coworkers by getting a job in a strategic place. So there's mechanisms, even when the momentum is lower, to lean on this more bottom-up type of organizing. I think that will, even in a moment of downturn, mean that unions can win more drives and build a more democratic unionism. They're just not going to be able to do that to the same extent as if it's in a moment of effervescence.
When you frame it this way, this model seems like a no-brainer for unions to implement. It solves, hopefully, or it could solve many of the most important problems facing labor, as you said, the scalability, and it's just the way you're pitching it is as a general way for labor to revitalize itself and to do so in a way that doesn't cost as much money as the staff intensive model. So my question is, what are the reasons why a union wouldn't implement a model like this? Because the way you frame it just makes it sound like, well, obviously this is a great way to deal with the issues that labor is up against. So why is there not a mass clamoring amongst the labor movement at this moment for this model to be implemented?
Well, hopefully my book will become a bestseller and there'll be a mass clamoring afterwards. But in the case that doesn't happen, it is worth understanding why there's so much sort of reluctance to move in this direction. The basic problem is that most unions aren't even trying to organize, period. So they're not even really thinking about the question. They're not really thinking, you know, what are the different models? What is the best way to do it? How are they accumulating experience? You know, what works? Most unions at this moment have seen their financial reserves really dramatically skyrocket over the last decade and aren't putting that towards new organizing. And there's various reasons for that. A lot of them think it's just not possible under, you know, current labor law. And that's a plausible, you know, we should say that's a plausible assumption. It's extremely hard to unionize in the United States because labor law is so weak, because employers are so hostile. And so it's not the case that worker-to-worker unionism is some sort of magic bullet, right? Like, we'll see what happens in these UAW drives. We'll see what happens at Starbucks. It seems like they've made a big breakthrough, but there's no guarantee. Just having a good organizing model doesn't automatically mean you win every time. They can win, they are winning, but a lot of unions are seeing, you know, they can point to things like the Amazon drive at JFK in Staten Island, where they win a union election, it hasn't spread. And they say, well, look, as long as labor law is as it is, we're not going to be able to really beat these big corporations. And so, you know, they do what they normally do, which is very little. They kind of just run their fiefdoms. At most, maybe they'll try to lobby the Democrats, get Democrats elected, maybe pass something like the PRO Act, which would be great. I'd love it if, you know, labor law reform would happen. But their theory of change, insofar as they have one, is just kind of unrealistic, because how are you ever going to get Congress to pass dramatic labor law reform, let alone force the Supreme Court to uphold it? Can you imagine if Congress actually passes labor law? The Supreme Court obviously is going to try to like knock it down the next day, unless there's a mass movement, as happened in the 1930s, that can force the Supreme Court to retreat and or force the Democrats to like pack the court. And so there isn't a world in which you could get to labor law reform unless you have a mass organizing effervescence. So basically, the existing theories for change aren't very realistic. And most unions, just to be honest, aren't trying. They're just kind of stuck in institutional inertia. There's a huge amount of risk aversion. There's a huge amount of bureaucratization. And so it's really, I think, going to be up to workers in these unions to transform the unions from below. The UAW is a very good example of this. The UAW is, you know, one of the worst unions in the country until very recently. It's still, you know, I still have to like pinch myself when I read about what Sean Fain and then the UAW are doing. It's just such a dramatic shift, because the UAW was incredibly corrupt, incredibly lethargic at best. And, you know, workers organized a caucus to boot out the old corrupt leadership, to democratize the union, and they won. They elected, you know, firebrand Christian socialists like Sean Fain, and just dramatically changed the entire culture of the union. But that didn't happen because they like begged the old leaders to change course. It happened because they organized. And so I think that that's one thing that workers can do, is kind of democratize unions from below. But it's also the case that new organizing puts pressure on existing unions to do more. So a very good example of this is the Starbucks campaign. You know, the Starbucks campaign was had a little bit of resources. It was given, you know, a tiny bit of resources from a small branch of a small union, the Rochester Regional Joint Board of Workers United. You know, so this is not like a mega institution, supported some young radicals salting essentially in Buffalo. And then it popped off, and this organizing then pushed Workers United, which had not been involved in a lot of new organizing, to throw down a lot of money to support the effort. And then that in turn, as the movement continued to spread and it continued to become union busting. That put a huge amount of pressure on an organization like SEIU, which for all of its pluses and minuses, hasn't been oriented towards sort of rank and file intensive organizing on a national level for many years now. And to its credit, SEIU, after a lot of internal debates, did end up giving a lot of money to the Starbucks campaign, a campaign that in many ways goes against sort of the longstanding sort of theory of change of many top SEIU leaders. And so you see that this bottom-up initiative then sort of pulls SEIU into supporting a different type of campaign. It's to its credit. And it shows that there's different ways of reforming the labor movement and sort of pulling the labor movement in a different direction.
You mentioned earlier the role of SALTs in this model and some of the drives that you interviewed workers from, as well as in the book you talk about the importance of a radicalization of young workers. Can you talk about how that's playing out in this model?
Yeah, the book is based in part off of a large-scale survey I did of over 500 worker organizers who sort of led union drives in 2022. And I had an intuition that this might be the case, but it turns out that, in fact, yes, the worker leaders of today's sort of effervescence in labor are overwhelmingly young. I believe the average age was 27, and they're overwhelmingly radical. About half consider themselves political radicals. The biggest influences on them were Black Lives Matter and Bernie Sanders. And so there's a generation of millennials and Gen Z. You know, Zoomers actually don't think we're, you know, part of the same generation. You know, so if you talk to the Zoomers, they think we millennials are like old fogies. But it turns out that, you know, millennials and Gen Z are both radicalized and both very focused on labor, which is sort of new for radicalization compared to maybe the norms in the 1960s, for instance. And so you have this generation of young people who are politicized by climate change, by Bernie, by BLM, but also by the Great Recession, the sort of neoliberalism's crisis, indebtedness, precarity. And so there is a generalized youth radicalization that has, over the last few years in particular, focused on unions as a mechanism to change the world on all of the issues that they're concerned about, whether it's systemic racism, whether it's LGBTQ rights, which is a very central dynamic in the Starbucks campaign, for instance, whether it's climate change, whether it's just sort of economic justice generally. People went to the BLM protest, they maybe volunteered for the Bernie campaign, and they came to the conclusion that for their agenda, you know, their wishes, what they want to see in the world to come true, you need power. And they see the labor movement as a mechanism to build power. It's a way that you can leverage your ability to withhold your labor. It's a space, the workplace, where you can talk to people who don't agree with you already, where you can build sustainable organizations. So there's an increased perception amongst young people that labor is sort of the path forward on all of these issues. And that's really exciting. I don't know how long that'll last. I hope it will continue to sort of drive things forward. But there is a generation gap at the moment in labor. And I think part of the reason unions aren't meeting the moment exactly is you do have a generation of people who maybe are leading unions who led some of the struggles in the 1990s and 2000s, the last sort of big attempt to turn things around for labor, and who kind of got burnt. You know, they tried somewhat to make a turn towards new organizing, and it didn't really meet their expectations. And a lot of them are worried about getting burnt twice. And they're older now, and they don't all of them see what's going on down below, in part because it's, you know, it's not their milieu. It's not the people that they're surrounded with all the time. And so there is a disconnect. And one of the ways we saw that recently, and I think is, you know, very interesting, is the big turning point for the Starbucks campaign ended up being, you know, because they ended up, just to flag, they ended up getting a major breakthrough. Starbucks is finally bargaining in good faith now. And so people said, well, how did this happen? Well, the straw that broke the camel's back was a boycott of Starbucks over Palestine. And this happened because, you know, rank and file workers and Starbucks Workers United insisted that the union from very early on take a strong stance in support of Palestine. And that became very controversial. The company tried to sue the union, and then it ends up getting picked up over TikTok and sort of goes viral over TikTok that you should boycott Starbucks because, you know, that they're, you know, backing or associated with the genocide in Gaza, you know, some of which is actually maybe it was a little bit confusing. People weren't exactly sure what was going on, but there was a there to Starbucks sort of taking the wrong position in relation to the union on this. And they end up losing $11 billion. It's just a huge financial crisis for them. And that wouldn't have happened if you hadn't had these young workers in the union, pushing at a time where no unions really were taking a stand in solidarity with Gaza. I believe Starbucks Workers United was the first union in the country to take a stand like that. And then you have via TikTok and, you know, millions of young people refusing to shop at Starbucks, sort of tanking the brand, tanking the sales, and then forcing management to the table. And so you really see there is something out there generationally that can be tapped. It's just a question of how to do it, you know, before the moment goes away.
So what's the upshot of that analysis for, let's say, a union leader who is interested in tapping into some of this energy and, you know, obviously revitalizing the labor movement as a whole? Is the takeaway that there is this sort of core of young people out there who are very radicalized and care about labor and see labor as the way to change the world in the ways that they want to change the world? And so for that union leader, there should be a willingness to tap into that spirit of these young people and get them to do things like engage in salting, that there are people who are willing to make those kind of serious life commitments around organizing a union in a non-union shop. What are all the take homes for those kinds of union leaders, given this nature of this newly politicized younger generation of workers?
Yeah, I think the first sort of takeaway is simple, but really important, which is just now is a good time to go big on new organizing. So it just, you know, inherently, the act of launching a big dramatic new organizing campaign is going to attract around you, your union, and amongst workers in the places that you're trying to unionize, some of these young radicalized workers. And so it's not just at a Starbucks or higher ed. The dynamic, for instance, in these auto plants, you know, just won in Volkswagen, hopefully will win in a couple of weeks in Mercedes, is that what changed from, you know, the previous attempts is that now young workers who in the past had been the sort of missing link, who, you know, were not voting for the union, now are overwhelmingly voting for union and are charged up about it. So you see across the board, it just there's way more potential than there used to be for organizing because this latent sort of youth radicalization. So that's part of it. You have to be ambitious. I think that young people and young sort of left-leaning activists in particular are going to gravitate to your campaigns, are going to want to dive in, not just for sort of small struggles, not for small-scale struggles, but to change the world, to win big, you know, to you know, defeat the billionaire classes, you know, Bernie said, and when you talk to them, that's how they're talking about it. They see this as part of a, you know, systemic struggle against capitalism. Not all of them, you know, it's uneven, but a lot of them really do see it that way. You know, a lot of them consider themselves socialists of some sort. And so unless you're sort of pitching the organizing, you know, it shouldn't be pitched in sort of political terms. It shouldn't sometimes be pitched as like a socialist thing, but in a way that meets the moment, you know, in the way that Sean Fain talks about it, where it's the working class versus the billionaire class, where this is a struggle of the haves against the have nots. You know, this sort of lofty sentiment is the spirit that moved the union movement in the 1930s. And it's the spirit that gets you to attract hundreds or more of salts, for instance. You know, this is really undertapped mechanism for spreading unionization. We've seen it succeed at Starbucks. It played an important role in Amazon as well. But just think about all the young people right now who are protesting around Gaza, for instance, in encampments. You know, there's a whole generation of people who are politicized and are trying to figure out how do we get the system to stop being so horrible? How do we change things? And for them, you know, unions are a central way to build real power. And so, you know, why aren't unions organizing, you know, dozens or more salting trainings all across the country? You know, every university, you should be going to protests, you should be going to classroom announcements saying, look, this summer, if you want to continue to change the world, here's a way to get involved. Fortunately, there is a new initiative, the Inside Organizer School, that some of the folks who started the Starbucks campaign, like Jazz Brzezak, Casey Moore, and others are sort of launching more publicly now, so people can start doing large scale salting. But really, every union should be doing this. Every union should be trying to say to young people, and, you know, not just young people, but in particular, this is a way you can change the world. Get involved with us. We will get you in a strategic campaign. We will take on the billionaire class and make history.
Well, anyone who is making proposals for labor's revitalization has to be a little cautious with what their predictions, right? Many people have said over a recent couple decades, like, well, if only labor does X, Y, and Z, then it'll be able to get back on its feet and get back to the kind of power that it had in its heyday or whatever. So, you know, we have to approach this analysis with some level of caution. But the best case scenario would be that this kind of worker-to-worker model could be adopted by more and more unions that could lead to the kind of scaling up of these organizing campaigns that you're talking about, and that it could sort of tap into, you know, that it could create a kind of organizational meeting of the political and economic moment on the part of labor, that there is clearly an incredible amount of excitement out there about unions. Young people in particular see unions as a solution to some of the problems that we face as a society and the world. And so if this model can allow for the kinds of scaling up that you're talking about, it certainly seems possible that we could see, you know, unions meeting this moment and exploding in not just popularity, but in membership, in the organizing of new shops and all of that. I guess that was the best case scenario to come out of this moment and a widespread adoption of the kind of organizing model you're talking about.
Yeah. The first thing I would say is I actually push back a little bit against this idea, which it gets brought up a lot, is to say, well, you know, labor's tried a lot of times to turn things around and it hasn't worked out. So we should be like pretty, you know, modest and cautious in what we're projecting as possible today. There's some truth to that. But the problem is that it's not actually true that labor has like gone all in on new organizing and has failed. That didn't happen in the 1990s. This was a big problem that happened in the 90s and 2000s. It's actually most unions didn't try to do new organizing. You know, the AFL-CIO and a few unions like SEIU did try. But for the most part, they couldn't convince everybody else to do it. They oftentimes couldn't convince their own locals to do it. And so it's not the case that they went all in and were defeated. They didn't even really attempt on a large enough scale to see whether it was possible in the 90s. Now, today we just know on a whole wide array of data points that the level of support for unionization is higher, that the level of grassroots activity is higher. And we're seeing that when unions do go all in, they're winning. So it's a really, really big deal, for instance, that Starbucks workers are now on a path to win a first contract. People sometimes pass that over a little bit glibly. This is a huge deal. It hasn't occurred since the 1930s that you've organized the big non-union companies at the heart of the U.S. economy, right? Same with auto right now. Like, who could have imagined a year ago that we'd be seeing already the first non-union auto factory go union at Volkswagen? But not only that, but it's spreading, you know, Mercedes and dozens of other shops now. So you do see that unionization, you do see that workers are winning first contracts. It's not just Starbucks, but you're seeing it places that I talk about in the book, like Colectivo, all across the New Guild, the Burgerville workers, and the Pacific Northwest. So people are winning first contracts. You're seeing unionization take off even more than sort of leaders could have hoped for in auto. And it gives you a sense of the possibilities. Now, of course, you never know what's going to happen. All other things being equal, labor usually loses because capitalists are just extremely powerful. So this is true. It is very much the case that we are going up against extremely powerful opponents. And so it's always risky. There's no guarantee. There isn't sort of a magic sauce. There's no silver bullet that will ensure that even a well-funded worker-to-worker sort of campaign will win. But the only way to find out is by trying. How else could you find out how far it's possible to go? And I think one of the reasons then that this moment is exciting is not just that workers are winning, but that there's a path to pushing the union movement down a different direction that wasn't really available in the 90s and 2000s, because then it was very much sort of reliant on trying to convince risk-averse officials to move in a different direction. And today, for the reasons that I explained, it's not as dependent on that. Workers are starting to organize oftentimes without existing established union support, and that kind of dragging unions into supporting them. That's a bit of the model of Starbucks Workers United. You're seeing the auto model in which workers take back their leaderships, take back their unions, and then launch massive campaigns. And so because it's not as contingent on trying to get these risk-averse union officials to move in a different direction, I'm more hopeful that it's possible to actually see this type of large-scale labor revitalization than was in the past. But again, it depends entirely on what people do. It depends on whether listeners to this podcast organize their shop through, you know, campaigns like EWOC, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which supports any new worker organizing, or if you're a union leader, whether you're going to put up a real fight, because it is a fight to get your union to start using resources to go all in now, not in like 5 years, now on new organizing. So that's why I don't think the prediction game is so helpful, because it's like organizing. You have to project some level of hope and confidence to get people into motion. And that in turn becomes, to a certain extent, a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you don't project that, if you don't try, then you never win.
Issues like those raised in today's podcast are taken up in classroom discussions at the CUNY School of Labor and Urban Studies, where our faculty and student body grapple with the challenges confronting labor and working class communities. To learn more about the school, visit slu.cuny.edu. To listen to more of the podcast, go to slu.cuny.edu/podcast. And to subscribe to New Labor Forum or sign up for our free monthly newsletter, visit newlaborforum.cuny.edu.